Hi, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
I love books so much that I'm going to marry books.
I have four books in my pocket right now.
Ever since Barack Obama admitted that he's for gay marriage, that means people can marry books now, right? So that's what's going
to
happen.
I think that's how it works. First you get to marry gays, then people will be marrying books.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Also, my shorts just split open and three of my books fell out.
It's one of them, the Bible.
What happens if you marry an anthology?
Polygamy!
Polygamy!
I'm going to marry the Norton Shakespeare.
I'm going to be a bibliopolygamist.
So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week we are discussing The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare.
Yeah, some guy named Bill.
Yeah, Bill. Bill Shakes. You know. But I guess first we should just give you our spoiler policy.
Yeah, our spoiler policy is this is Shakespeare and we can't spoil it.
Yeah. This play was written 500 years ago, and if you don't know... Even if you don't know this play, like, it was written 500 years ago.
Yes, officially our spoiler policy is we will spoil everything, but I think this week we don't really need to warn you all that in depth.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this because you have to read in class, then you don't care if we're spoiling because you're using us instead.
That's right. The spark notes of podcasting.
But just in case you didn't know, Ben did want to drop one spoiler ball on you.
Oh yeah, Shylock is a Jew. Now you know.
That's not a surprise. By the way, he's not like a secret Jew that pops out in Act 5.
Well, I didn't figure it out until the 5th act, but apparently if reading Shakespeare isn't hard for you, you can figure it out a lot sooner than that.
Yeah.
Like, people call him a Jew directly like 374 times or something like that. I don't know. Yeah.
At least. For our listener response from last week, we did have a note from Doug, who is one of our sci-fi fans.
Yes.
And he actually commented on our Independence Day joke about all the ships coming down and hovering over the major cities of the world. And he said he read or watched an interview with Roland Emmerich where he actually said that the idea of the ships in Independence Day hovering over the cities is from Childhood End.
So how about that?
Yeah, and that there are other elements of the movies they borrowed from other science fiction.
Yeah, like the computer virus is like the cold virus at the end of War of the Worlds.
Yeah, or David booting up his computer and it's saying, "Good morning, Dave."
HAL 9000 style.
Yeah, another Arthur C. Clarke reference, actually.
Yes. And he also mentioned that Arthur C. Clarke has a tendency to write novels with some interesting ideas, but where the characters don't necessarily ever become all that interesting. And I'll agree with that. Arthur C. Clarke's novels do tend to have two or three big ideas in them, loosely tied together, and probably could do a better job of that. But also, it got me thinking a little bit about one thing that I see in science fiction and fantasy, especially, probably really in any fiction, it's just what I mostly read. But there are stories that are a little more premise or concept-based, and there are stories that are a little more character-based. And in a lot of science fiction, especially older science fiction, because I think modern science fiction tends to be more commercial, more like a regular commercial novel, where people want stories and characters. But in science fiction, you can take a big idea and kind of play with it, and if your universe and your concept is interesting enough, people will go ahead and read it anyway.
Right, whereas a more character-based book might be Game of Thrones.
Yeah. You have tons of characters, you get to be inside all of their heads, and the concept is, well, extremely generic. It's fantasy, medieval setting, politics, and war.
Right.
And lots of rape.
Whereas, you need to give a warning before you say that word.
I don't remember that.
Whereas, Childhood's End is definitely, what if all the world's children turned into weird psychic things?
Then it would be sad, especially if you're an alien, apparently.
We're just, like, boiling Arthur C. Clarke's works down into derivative sentences.
Novel Ideas Podcast, where we give extremely fair representations of everything. So we have a very special episode this week.
We do.
We have a guest. You've already heard him laugh. He even spoke before he was supposed to. But we're going to let him do the rest of the podcast anyway.
Yeah, so we have with us today Dr. Anthony Funari, PhD of English Literature.
Even specializes in Renaissance bullshit or something like that.
Thank you, Ben.
That's what it says.
You.
That's what it says on the degree, I think.
What?
Yes. That was. Thank you for saying that about the past 12 years of my life. I really feel.
What is
validated.
Your specialty?
My specialty is late 16th century, 17th century British literature.
That sounds suspiciously like Shakespeare.
That is. It is.
It includes Shakespeare.
It includes Shakespeare. I'm not exactly a Shakespearean, but I have studied and written about him.
Mm-hmm. I'd say he's closer to being a Shakespearean than both of us.
Well,
although...
that's fair because I'm barely even literate.
Wow. Admitting it is the first step, okay?
Words are hard. Why can't I watch TV instead?
We can get you some picture books.
A picture book of the Merchant of Venice.
Just make sure it's pretty.
I did focus on Shakespeare in my undergraduate degree, so I am closer than Ben, but I don't have a PhD. So
that's right.
I have an undergraduate thesis.
Tony is also the proud author of a book about Bacon.
Yeah. Francis Bacon and the 17th Century Intellectual Discourse.
Yes, specifically... Francis Bacon, who, based on my usual light research, invented science.
Maybe wrote Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah. And then married a 14-year-old when he was 67, which is a good trick because he was already dead.
Tony, your response.
My response. Well, that's a bit of a gloss. A bit. You know, he Bacon did come up with... somewhat of the scientific method. He did believe in the idea of empiricism and looking at a physical facts to form base conclusions off of. He did marry eventually at the end of his life, but probably that was more for monetary gain rather than for any love. Most likely, Bacon, if we looked at his personal life today, a lot of biographers say he was probably homosexual.
Yeah, didn't he have, young boys running
Yes, he
house.
Did, yeah. He actually had to flee Spain because of rumors being spread about him being a pederast.
Yeah.
So there's that.
There's that.
He also was an incredible lawyer, rose very high in the James I's government, became his...
it's because James I was also gay. Maybe.
I think my light research included that tidbit. Yeah. By light research, by the way, that's code for I read the Wikipedia article.
So,
I have to go adjust that.
If Francis Bacon was maybe gay, or not, gay, because they didn't
have
a concept of gay,
right.
but preferred men, then maybe he did write this play because of it.
The Bacon as potentially Shakespeare, which, by the way, is such a weak theory that Wikipedia didn't even bother to mention.
Well, he was the first candidate, other than Shakespeare, proposed for the authorship question.
Right, and we're going to talk about that authorship question just briefly.
In quotation marks.
Quotations question.
Yeah.
Between Roland Emmerich and Francis Bacon, I think we've... made enough of an excuse to talk about it.
Yeah, for anyone who saw the movie Anonymous that came out last fall, which proposes that Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, is the true author of Shakespeare's plays, that is currently the most popular theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at de Vere's life, it seems like there's a lot of stuff that happened in his life that happened in Shakespeare's plays. Seems to be the gist of that argument.
Yes, but always that one big problem with that theory. He died in 1604. The plays kept being written until 1611.
Although the argument against that is
that... The Tupac argument?
Yeah, right. Yeah, the Tupac argument.
Yes, well, the argument for people who believe in de Vere... is that all the plays were actually written before 1604, and then after that, people just kind of tweaked them and then put them on stage and presented them as new work.
Yeah, but most likely, there's the tweaking is actually so structural and so fundamental to the plays itself that they would actually have they be rewritten then if they were actually written beforehand. So
the other thing that I don't get that maybe you can enlighten me on is that there were multiple people who already respected Oxford as a playwright while he was alive. We have poems that he wrote. I don't think we have any of his plays.
No. Only
so if people knew him as a poet and a playwright, why would he have to write a bunch of plays in secret?
There's really no good reason for that. I mean, to actually have your plays performed, to get paid to have your plays put on, would have been seen as beneath someone of Edward de Vere's class.
Okay.
So he couldn't publicly put on his plays at the Globe. That would have been seen as beneath him, and he would have been looked down upon for that. I mean, as we see it today, for someone, for an artist to have achieved success, it's usually because their work is very, very popular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sells a lot of copies. It becomes a bestseller. A lot of people buy tickets to go see it, blah, 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 blah. In the Renaissance, that wasn't a mark of how good of a writer or artist you were, actually. By actually selling your work to a theater company would have been actually seen as demeaning your actual plays and whatnot.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I think that people who think they're creative and don't make any money in modern times like to think of art that way sometimes still. But I think a modern author would probably disagree with that interpretation. It's like, no, you sell your work, that's the best sign of appreciation you can get.
Exactly. Nowadays it is for us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud to say I've gone beyond light research on this. I've actually read a handful of academic articles. I mean, not recently, but over the years. And my impression of the Shakespeare authorship debate is very much that the people who question whether Shakespeare wrote the plays are people who like to have conspiracy theories, and this is a hobby for them.
Yes.
So yes, I'm just going to go ahead and dismiss all that with the wave of my unacademic hand.
The other thing I would say about Anonymous is it is like, conspiracy number one, De Vere wrote Shakespeare's plays. Conspiracy number two, conspiracy number three, and it all ends up as, oh, De Vere's actually Elizabeth's son and then slept with her and had a kid with her, and I was like, really? People think that.
Yeah.
All
well,
right.
Yeah.
So, I think, I mean, obviously it's not really important if Shakespeare wrote the play, because we have the play, and regardless of who wrote it, its merits are the same, so that doesn't change our opinion, but, you know, just so everyone knows where we stand on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as, I like to look at people who promote this idea of Shakespeare didn't write his plays, like, oh, it was a big conspiracy, didn't you hear about Edward de Vere? These are people who like to sound intelligent without actually being intelligent.
Sophists.
Yes. I remember when I was teaching this one class, and we were doing one of Shakespeare's plays, I forget which one, and every class I always had a student, and it just drove me nuts, would raise his hand and say, well, didn't someone else write these plays? And he would challenge me, and initially it would go on, like, it would diverge conversation for like 5-10 minutes. No, he didn't. Here's the reasons why. And I keep reiterating these points. And then I realized, wait, he's only doing this because he has nothing else to contribute to the conversation.
He didn't actually fucking read the play.
So this is his way of actually sounding intelligent, with actually being intelligent.
Here's some student smartassery to divert the class. And so when Dr. Frenari is assigning participation points, he remembers that I spoke for 10 minutes one
right.
And actually, if you think about it, probably a lot of the people who say, didn't Shakespeare not write the plays?
Mm-hmm.
They probably haven't read a lot of Shakespeare.
Right.
And you can always argue, okay, who cares? The plays are the same.
Right. I mean,
that's what we're studying.
Yeah.
Right. The play is still the same. And you know what? I'm just going to start claiming that I wrote them.
Yes!
That's a 500-year-old vampire.
Wow. This works for me. New conspiracy theory.
Although we are still waiting to hear from our 500-year-old English gentleman. So if any of you live at the same time as Shakespeare,
that's right.
Could maybe clear up the issue.
If that guy wants to get into the comment thread and tell us if he ever saw a Shakespeare play and ever met Mr. Shakespeare, and whether he was capable of writing the plays, and if he knew the grammar school, and whatever. Okay, let's get past this authorship.
Yes,
thank you.
So let's move on. So why did we choose this play in the first place? Well, first of all, we chose it because Tony...
it's fucking Shakespeare.
Well, okay. my God. Well, we wanted Tony to be a guest on the show, and his one of his specialties is Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And then he and I were discussing it, and we thought, okay, what's a Shakespeare play most people have had to read or have at least heard about and has good issues to talk about? Merchant of Venice.
Yeah.
Is a pretty hot button topic play.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who, you know, has ever learned about the Holocaust and the treatment of Jews.
Yes.
And any of that.
And while they were throwing names of plays back and forth, my contribution was, Shakespeare is hard.
Oh, Ben.
I was like, Twelfth Night, Christmas play?
Well, it's based on the Holocaust. Move on with that one. One of the other reasons we kind of chose the play, though, is because Tony has actually taught the play.
Yes, I have.
And in some pretty funny circumstances.
Yes, well, it was a few years ago. I was teaching up in New York City full-time in a high school, public high school, and I took a part-time job teaching at a yeshiva, which is a Jewish boarding school, basically. And I met with the principal. He was a very nice man. He was a rabbi, and we started going over what I would teach, and he said, we want the students to read a Shakespeare play. I said, okay, great. Which one do you have in mind? And he said, we'd like you to teach Merchant of Venice. I was like, wow, okay.
A little bit of a brave decision.
Right. I was like, wow, this will present an interesting teaching challenge, a pedagogical moment for me. I was like, okay, this could be fun. I embraced the challenge. And so I did it. I was having some success with it. I mean, and halfway through the term, I met up with the rabbi again, and he asked me how I was doing. I said, I really enjoy teaching here. I like the students. And he asked me, well, how's the Merchant of Venice going? I've never read it. It's like, so you don't know what this play's about? No! God!
Wow!
Wow! You just chose this at random, didn't you? Okay.
That's so
well... Allow me to enlighten you.
You do realize you just asked me to teach your Jewish students...
Like, the most anti-Semitic play Shakespeare ever wrote. Wow. Okay, all right. Thank you.
That's...
awesome.
That's kind of amazing, yeah.
Yes, okay, there was that I what I did include was the 5 minutes of just blank staring I had after he said that to me.
Right.
Like...
That's because silent blank staring doesn't make for good podcasting.
This is true.
And I feel like if you were a principal and you were Jewish, you would know that.
Yeah.
You would think so.
It's a pretty big issue.
Yeah.
In the world of scholarship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you. Okay. That's kind of awesome. So let's move on to the actual discussion of the book. So what is it play.
Play.
Whatever.
But it's all bound up in a book.
Script.
Exactly.
Script.
Exactly.
Script.
What's the genre?
Shakespeare.
That's Ben's contribution.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
Isn't that a genre?
It is.
Basically.
In the first folio, it's grouped under the romantic comedies. Or the romances.
And... the kind of interesting thing about this is because of the character of Shylock and the Jewish issue, it's kind of easy to read the play as a tragedy to a modern-day audience.
To a modern-day audience, absolutely. To Shakespeare's audience, not so much. To us, absolutely.
It does have funny moments.
Oh my God, yeah.
But I would say ultimately when the trial scene happens, I'm more sad for Shylock than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll definitely get... in depth on that in a few minutes here.
So technically a comedy, maybe a tragedy, but yeah, so we don't really know, I guess.
I think it's a thriller with a huge plot twist.
No.
I'm still reeling from finding out Shylock is a Jew.
I guess as we were saying, it would be grouped into with other plays like Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure,
is also kind of a debatable
comedy. It's one of the problem plays. It would have been grouped in with As You Like It, those type of plays. Much Ado About Nothing,
which are all Much Ado and As You Like It are pretty obviously comedies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Even to a modern day audience.
Rom-com even.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, here's the one where we forced the Jew to convert, lol.
Lol.
Wow, that is a funny joke.
Wow. And took all his money away, too.
Yeah, it's hilarious because Jews are greedy.
So. Right, clearly. Yeah.
That's not me speaking.
That is 16th century England speaking.
This is heavy, heavy irony, guys. Plot synopsis. So, my plot synopsis is the Jew gets screwed over and... Wait, there's another part to the play?
My synopsis is Christians are dicks. Everyone gets married. Hooray!
I think the main thing that goes on about The Merchant of Venice is that Shylock becomes the dominant character in your mind, even if he doesn't get the most stage time, that it's kind of easy to forget everything else.
Well, he also has the most powerful monologues. At least for us today. He
really
does.
Definitely.
I mean, that, and that's one of the brilliance of Shakespeare. He gives characters that normally would treat just as stock characters or caricatures these brilliant monologues and makes them so sometimes introspective. And with Shylock, he's just so quick to point out the hypocrisy around him. And he does it in such a succinct, cutting way.
It's hard to blame Shylock when he says stuff like, you want me to lend you money and you spit on me last week and called me a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so, now you're insulting me for lending you money.
So yeah, I don't like you very much.
Yeah.
Right. And also, you know, Antonio's taking away his livelihood because Antonio keeps bailing people out of the debt that they have to Shylock.
Mm-hmm.
and making interest-free loans to everybody and taking away Shylock's profession.
So,
yeah, if you're in the loan business, that would be
a dick move.
Yeah.
And you should also mention that at this time, Jews and Christians in general didn't get along very well. So there's also just kind of that general vague hatred toward each mm-hmm. other of just the fact that they're different religions.
I think it's easy to forget how deeply anti-Semitism ran in Europe historically.
Absolutely.
And we kind of referenced it earlier, but post-Holocaust, mm-hmm. I think everyone kind of had to reevaluate
mm-hmm.
on that. And like, it's one of those things that is really hard to understand because it just seems so silly in hindsight. Like, what reason is there for it?
To us, it seems nonsensical.
Right.
It's kind of like the idea of racism.
Mm-hmm.
When we were growing up, the first time my mom ever told me, oh yeah, black people used to not be able to vote, I was like, what the? That doesn't even make sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. I'm like, why in the world would you discriminate against Jewish people? That makes no sense.
Right. Well, I mean, you can
To us.
Right.
Yes.
Well, with racism, you can at least, you glance at someone and you can see that there is a difference in coloring, whereas with anti-Semitism, a lot of Jews just look like other white people. Like, I don't know why it was such a deep divide.
Did they wear
specialized
clothing?
They did. Especially during the Spanish Inquisition, the Morenos, these were the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. They had to wear outfits made of red. They had to wear red that marked them off as Jewish.
Which is a little Nazi-ish.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot where, you can see there's a lot of parallels, okay? And, so during the Spanish Inquisition, they were seen as different. And also, they lived apart from the rest of the community. They lived in ghettos. I mean, that's where we get the term from.
Okay.
So that's, they were considered alien and marked and set apart as different from their communities.
So it's kind of a weird divide to cross. When we read Shylock, we're coming from a totally different place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And maybe we're not interpreting the play the way Shakespeare intended or the way Elizabethan audiences did, but
I'll guarantee you we're not interpreting it the way Elizabethan audiences did.
Not by a long shot.
Elizabethan audiences, the play probably didn't end and they were like, man, Christians are dicks.
That's probably not a thought that people really had.
Just by Act 5, that's what I'm always doing. Like, really, guys? You are the worst Christians ever. Like, oh yeah, mercy. That's what you have. You have to be more merciful, Shylock, but now we're going to destroy your entire life.
Yeah, you should be nicer, you stupid Jew.
Yeah, now we're going to take away all your money and make you convert because we're so merciful.
It's okay, we're saving you.
Yes, exactly.
I actually did have a professor, I think, mention at one point that the forced conversion of Shylock, instead of being viewed as just an ultimate dick move, mm-hmm. which is how I see it, could actually be viewed by a Christian audience as mercy. They're saving him.
I actually assume that was the intent.
So
there.
It is that's part of the comedy trope because this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
In
right.
a year, Shylock will thank us. Mm-hmm. Kind of
We've
thing.
Saved his soul.
Right.
When he dies, he'll definitely thank us.
Yeah.
He dies penniless in an alley in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
As to the setting, it's pretty obvious from the title. The Merchant of Venice.
So, a lot of it happens in Venice.
If you people don't know, Venice is in Italy. I hope I didn't have to clarify that for anyone, but yeah, you never know. The other setting is Belmont.
Where the horse races happen.
Which... Ben, you are fired. I'm hiring Tony.
That was me.
I'm just trying to bring some scholarship into this podcast.
Belmont is Portia's kind of little magical mansion on an island.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty
basically,
cool.
It was like a duchy.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
And it is... Venice is much more grounded in the realism, and Belmont has a much more fantastical mm-hmm. feeling to it.
Right.
With the... Three Caskets, which is kind of a fairy tale trope, mm-hmm. and everyone's in love, and mm-hmm. everything magically gets solved here. So there's definitely a divide between the two settings.
Right. There's a distinct divide.
And then it takes place during the Renaissance, kind of.
Well, yeah, the play was, scholars date the play to about 1596. The first quarto that was published of the play was 1600. The second quarto was 1610. And then we have the first folio of 1623.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thinks the first quarto was the prompt book that the Shakespeare's theater company, the actors.
Struggling with that a little bit.
The Lord Strangeman's actually used.
Okay, so... The thing the actors used to kind of prompt them
right.
when they were,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
The master script, basically. Okay. Because it included all the entrances and exits.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's contemporary with roughly the year 1600. We'll just throw it out there. Which I believe is still the Renaissance.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is still the Renaissance.
Unless you're a musician, then it's Baroque.
You know what they say about
Baroque? Actually, it's right on the border, so we won't get into that.
And then it's not really an interesting point of view or tense because it's a play.
Yeah. Yeah.
Present tense.
That is the
characters
tense.
Are talking.
It's a play.
There's not really anything. Okay, so who is... We've talked about Shylock a little bit, although there's still a lot more to uncover, but is he the protagonist of the play?
I think it's easy to read it that way. As a modern audience, then the most interesting plot line definitely features Shylock, you know. More about how he feels than anyone, at least within that plot line.
Yeah.
He's the, well, I think the only interesting character in the play.
But Antonio is the title character. He is the merchant of Venice. And he shows up right at the beginning of the play with, you know, the incidental other characters. But he doesn't talk that much, and you don't really know... Yeah. That much about him, except that he loves Bassanio a lot.
Yes, he does.
Not necessarily in a sexual way, but we'll talk about that.
At the very least, there is a heavy-duty bromance going on.
Yeah, definitely a heavy-duty
bromance. For sure. Yeah. But Tony can make a different argument.
Well, you know, if we're looking at it as the set as one of the comedies, really the protagonist should be... You know, Bassanio and Portia. And if we think about it, Portia is the character that brings the play to its conclusion. She's the one that resolves the crisis. So it, she, you could see she's very comparable to Viola in Twelfth Night.
Right.
Or Rosalind in As You Like It. I mean, she's the one that, you know, brings the play to the conclusion. However, you know, for modern audiences, and even back, even before, really, into the 19th century when the play was performed, people were noticing this is Shylock's play. Shylock's the most interesting character. Shylock's the one who kind of, again, has the most powerful speeches.
You can kind of think of it, and this is probably a comparison that's going to piss you off, but when the Pirates of the Caribbean movie came out, Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley, technically the main characters of that movie, the entire plot is around her getting kidnapped and Orlando Bloom wanting to go save her, but then Johnny Depp sails on the scene as Jack Sparrow, and immediately everyone forgets about every other character.
Right.
Because he is by far the most compelling character in that movie. But at the end of it, you could make the argument that he's not the main character. Mm. So I kind of think of that. I mean, again, the parallel is not entirely fair. But think of that parallel in my head, that Bassanio and Portia are kind of the romantic interest couple that's driving most of the plot, because Bassanio wants the money and Portia fixes everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then Shylock's kind of the Captain Jack Sparrow who sneaks in and steals the scene. I don't know. I think...
Wow.
Put into some context.
I think you just broke me.
I think it works.
Damn.
I'm going to put on production where Shylock comes out with like the dreads and the beads. He's so savvy at the end of all his lines.
I will boycott your play. I will protest your play.
Everyone else will fucking love it.
That's
damn,
right.
I don't even care. I get what you're saying about Portia being kind of a Viola figure from Twelfth Night, but the difference is that Viola is super interesting, and we get a lot of her monologues and her inner thoughts and processes, and she comes across as a lot more sympathetic to me than Portia does, who at times just kind of seems like a jerk.
I thought Portia was a promising character who never quite realized her potential, because she had like a little streak of bitchiness, like in a good way. Though.
Yes, and her opening scene is hilarious.
Yes. Yeah. And I thought she was going to be the one who is just like poking fun at the whole state of affairs the whole time. And I guess she kind of is, but like the whole final prank she pulls, I don't really care. I guess her initial conversation about the various suitors and some of the stereotyping that happens in there is... There's some pretty funny stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of wanted her to get a little deeper into the character of each of them. Like, I wanted her to give us another 4 or 5 lines of insults for each of those characters. And then her interaction with the Prince of Morocco was kind of blah. He did most of the talking. And...
Right.
Well, and then when that scene ended, Ben and I both reached the conclusion of Portia's a racist. Which... you care to argue?
Dig in. Give us some context.
Okay. referring to like, I hope all choose like he all of his complexion chooses as he does.
Right.
Right? And then, well,
because he lost.
Right. Because he lost.
Right. To marry a black.
Well, there's a couple things. One, complexion can be glossed as temperament. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily have to refer to skin pigmentation. Also, the idea of race is more of a modern idea than it was back in Shakespeare's day. There was no, in the fact that, let's say, in Shakespeare's plays, such as like Othello or the Prince of Morocco here, or even Aaron, which is another Moorish character from one of the very, very early plays, their physical feature is noticed, but they're never marked as, like, say, inferior racially, as, you know, we've modern racism usually works. For them, it was seen more as a cultural difference in a lot of ways. And
there's still an other, though, right?
There's still another, yeah. There's still another. But if we think about it, you know, Shakespeare was way more progressive with regards to what we might consider interracial marriages than some of the films today are. I mean, he actually shows us an interracial couple that's
before Iago gets to them, is kind of they're happy.
Yeah, they are.
They're happy that we actually get a moment where they kiss on stage. Can you think of the last time you saw in a film and two people of different races kiss in a film?
No.
So the first example that pops into my head is the third Austin Powers movie.
Okay, jeez. Well,
no, Beyonce kisses him at the very end.
That's true.
Although...
Hancock?
One of the things I did notice about Austin Powers...
Actually, really racist, Phil.
That film is... Beyonce and Austin Powers do kiss at the end of that movie, but the previous two Powers girls, or whatever the hell you want to call them... both have sex with him before the end of the movie, so they actually did even rein that way back.
So seriously, for Shakespeare's time, this idea of interracial couples or miscegenation, that wasn't as much of a taboo as it is today.
You're like a proto-racist to that.
Because regardless, one of the things that I noticed is before Morocco shows up, because he is kind of a prig, he's not great, but before he shows up, she actually does make the comment, even if he has the personality of an angel or a saint, I don't care because I don't like his skin color. So I think you can argue that Portia's still not, she doesn't want to marry a black guy.
We could also look at it in a sense that this is just questions of standards of beauty too. In Shakespeare's day, the ideal standard of beauty would have been someone who was incredibly fair complexioned.
Oh, yeah.
Really fair. You know, blue eyes.
Oh, my paleness.
Pale, blue eyes.
Exactly. Yeah. And, the idea that, the darker complexioned you were, the less you were at that standard of beauty. So it might be just more of a personal preference, too.
The other argument I could potentially make in favor of Portia is that I think it's pretty clear she wants to marry Bassanio.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't like him based on that.
Mm-hmm. Finding excuses to not like him maybe a little bit.
Yeah, kind of. No, he's not Bassanio, and he's dark, so whatever.
So there's an excuse for me.
But it still is.
Even if racism wasn't really a thing the way we recognize it, you can still tastes like it.
Okay.
It's like someone who got executed for buggery. They don't have a concept for homosexuality, but you can recognize homophobia when you see it still.
Yeah.
For sure. And that if you're mostly interested in sleeping with guys, even if you don't think of yourself as gay, then back then you probably fit the modern construct of it. Even if you were married to a woman, which what they did.
Yeah, which is,
As was and is standard.
Yeah, if you slept with guys, doesn't mean that excluded you from wanting to sleep with women.
Right.
It was very fluid.
Well,
yeah, you can still run a super church.
Yeah.
I was going to make the argument that if you were a duke or an earl... Well, it doesn't really matter if you're interested in your wife because nobody was interested in their wife.
Right, exactly.
And you have to carry on your family name. Mm-hmm. So just do your duty and sleep with your wife and then,
Yeah, once she has a couple sons, you want an emergency backup son just in case.
Right, exactly.
You can make out with some dudes in the back.
Right, there you go.
Get your page boy up there.
Don't worry about it. Speaking of the sexuality issues, since we're talking about it already... verdict, is Antonio gay or not?
I feel like he probably is not meant to be. But, again, as a modern reader, you really want him to be. It's oh, poor guy, he's in love with Bassanio, and Bassanio likes chicks.
Yeah, when the play opens, the first line is him saying, I don't know why I'm so depressed, basically. And it's kind of easy to read it as he's in love with Bassanio, and Bassanio doesn't return the affection to the same degree.
And he does profess his love for Bassanio on multiple occasions.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially in the trial scene.
Especially in the trial scene.
They say some pretty good stuff in there.
Well, in that trial scene, he actually says, I would give up everything, including my wife,
for you.
Yeah.
And then Portia has that great line.
I don't think your wife would really appreciate hearing that.
I don't think she liked that very much. And then Antonio has some sort of line like, make sure your wife knows that once Bassanio was loved, like, I am the greatest lover of your life. They're pretty extreme. It actually comes across as a little over the top. Yeah.
It does, yes.
But then there was this idea, you know, that sometimes the bond between men, which doesn't necessarily have to be sexual, was always supposed to be greater than the bond you had with your wife.
Manly combining.
Exactly.
Wasn't it called, or at least James first, the cult of friendship?
Yes.
Am I remembering that term mm-hmm. right?
Yes, you are.
Where to be completely devoted to a male friend and tell him that you loved him mm-hmm. and all that stuff wasn't considered romantic at all. Mm-hmm. It's just what you did with your guy
right.
friends that you
mm-hmm.
really cared about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you read letters of authors trading back and forth I love yous, that doesn't
yeah.
necessarily mean anything.
So the intent
right.
here was probably to show that they were just really strong friends
yes.
in
right.
that mold of friendship.
Exactly. Exactly.
But in the fifth act, mm-hmm. when Antonio's life has been saved and everyone's all done telling him how much they love him, you do still have the three heterosexual couples, and then Antonio is just
standing on his
right.
own,
left alone. Mm-hmm.
Which is
Antonio.
Which is typical for Shakespeare's comedies. I mean, every comedy, there's always that one person left out at the end. In Much Ado About Nothing, it's Don Pedro. In Midsummer Night's Dream, it's Aegeus. In As You Like It, it's Jacques. There's always that one person who's not integrated back into the, you know, heterosexual community.
And I do actually think it's kind of interesting that the other Antonio in Shakespeare's plays
is
also pretty intensely dedicated to one of his guy friends and ends up not with anybody at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of, this is totally not even valid, but I kind of like the little idea that Shakespeare had a buddy named Antonio who's like
no.
totally in love with a guy and he's like, come to write my plays. Which is, you know, just bullcrap.
Fangirl head fantasy.
Are we doing
let's see if Edward de Vere had a friend named Antonio.
Yeah. Stop that now.
I'm going to have to insist you not do that again.
Okay, so we have Antonio, we have Portia. What about Bassanio?
Bland Bassanio?
Yeah. Not a very interesting character.
He's the, I spent all my daddy's trust fund money, so I need a loan guy.
Yeah. And Antonio is, oh, well, I love you. Have some money.
Mm-hmm. Or have
I'll borrow it against my giant fleet of trade ships mm-hmm. that nothing could possibly go wrong with.
Because uh-huh.
they're going in separate corners of the world.
Right.
I do like when Bassanio enters and he's having the conversation with Antonio. In the speech where he's describing Portia, he focuses a lot on gold metaphors. Basically, like, she's super rich.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
It almost sounds like he's more in love with her money than
yeah.
with her.
He's
which,
a gold digger.
Yeah. I would say it's pretty accurate.
I'd say he's the straight man in this cast, too.
Yeah. Yeah. He's dull. He's boring. He's, yeah.
He doesn't really do that much.
No.
Know?
Yeah, even though you could, I guess he is technically the protagonist for the rom-com half mm-hmm. of it.
Well, how do you think he chooses the lead casket?
Well, he chooses it because Portia leads him there, because of the song that's played.
I just assumed he was familiar with fairy tales and knew that it's always going to be the lead casket.
I like the idea of Portia just pointing to the lead
casket. Yeah, that's exactly
right. Like,
he's like, well, there's gold, which is amazing, like her hair, and there's silver,
right.
which is slightly less amazing, but still pretty cool, and like, she's going, the lead one the whole time.
But you know,
he's like, and then there's the lead. Hey, wait a minute. Like, he's looking back and forth, like Vader between the Emperor and
well, it's kind of interesting, too, if you compare it to like the world of Venice versus world of Belmont. In the world of Venice, gold is prized. I mean,
uh-huh.
everybody's about their gold, and Shylock is the embodiment of this. Whereas in the world of Belmont, it's lead that's prized. It's what you have to look beyond the gold. You have to look to the substance of something.
And in Belmont, money is not an issue.
Right.
Porsche
exactly.
Filthy rich. Right.
That's 3, why they 000. Can afford all those racehorses.
Yeah. That's how he got his money.
That's right.
At the racetrack.
Oh, no.
Damn.
No.
He's corrupting me. Ben, stop it.
No. When she's like, oh, Antonio needs 3,000 ducats, no problem. Actually, just make it 6,000 yeah. just to sweeten. Yeah, just
and triple that.
Triple it.
Yeah, why not?
Make it 30,000.
Yeah, whatever.
And break care. The bond.
I don't give a shit.
My dad's Tywin Lannister. He shits gold.
I mean, honestly, Porsche is ridiculously rich.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that Bassanio would be attracted to that.
It makes sense that she had so many suitors. Uh-huh. Plus, apparently, yeah. she was super hot.
Yeah, apparently.
Oh. She was fair skinned and blonde haired. Mm-hmm.
There is kind of an interesting point there of why the hell, if she wants to marry Bassanio, does she just not ignore her dad's casket will thing?
That did bother me. It's like, hey, he's dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, culturally. To do so would have been an incredible taboo. I mean, this, again, the idea of, especially in Shakespeare, well, in a lot of Shakespeare's plays, the patriarchal rule was very much revered. You know, you are your father's to give away, okay? You don't have the capability of choosing on your own, all right? So even from beyond the grave, we still don't believe you have the ability to choose the proper husband. So I'm going to have a will that stipulates, in a way, I'm making the choice for you.
So you think the money was tied to that in a way where she had to follow the rules, perhaps?
Someone was, like, watching her, making sure.
That's the only thing that makes sense to me. Like, there had to be some executor off in the corner.
I'm sure.
It is kind of weird to me, though, because a lot of those patriarchal figures in Shakespeare's plays often seem to make bad decisions that mm-hmm. everyone has to follow.
And the women, like, he likes the women to be kind of smart and be a little more clever than the men sometimes.
Right, and she is. She finds a way around it.
Right.
By having that one song played that leads Bassanio to choosing the right casket. Which is kind of clever on her part.
Yeah, well, also, the other thing that made me wonder why go through the whole casket thing in the first place was in the fifth act when she was basically fucking with her new husband. But it's like, okay, well, you finally chose correctly and you're my husband and now I'm going to mess with you and make it sound like basically we're not actually going to have a marriage at all. And then why'd you go through the whole thing with the caskets? Like, if you're just going to now ignore it, shouldn't he have been a little more suspicious?
Yeah.
Or is it because he's just too bland to have thoughts?
Yeah. I think that, yeah.
He and Antonio are too busy making eyes at each other.
He wasn't. He thinks his mind was in a different place.
You're going to fund our illicit homosexual relationship, Portia. Like, whatever. I'm just saying.
Okay.
It's possible.
It's possible. I would say he's dumb because he needs to be dumb to make the joke work.
He's dumb. He is dumb for dramatic purposes.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I could, yeah. could say that. Could see that.
Yeah, it's like, why doesn't Hamlet kill Claudius or Claudius in the first act? Well, because we wouldn't have the rest of the play.
Exactly.
Because Hamlet's a worthless piece of crap.
Well, there's also that. But that is for another time and place.
Only Joe Christmas is more inconsistent in his thoughts.
Oh, God.
Not to go on a tangent here.
The most horrible.
Okay, well, how about we hit a couple of the secondary characters, because Shylock's going to be a long conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, Narissa. Narissa?
Narissa?
Narissa.
Rhymes with Melissa.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't even need to be in the play. Let's throw that out there.
Well, she's Portia's female companion.
Portia mm-hmm. needs somebody to say her witty lines to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she needs a female companion.
Yeah, well, she could say them to the audience, like it's not without precedent.
She needs a female companion. It's another role for a woman in the play, damn it.
Well, not actually.
Well, I know it would have been a boy.
Yeah.
You know.
And then there is Graziano, who another character who I thought might be promising. at the beginning because he seemed like he's going to be the windbag character who just said way too much but said nothing, which I kind of have a soft spot for, surprisingly.
That's what.
And then he really doesn't speak more than a sentence at a time after that, and it's mostly to be the anti-Semitic hype man to Portia's legalistic poning of Shylock in the trial.
Do not forget the dick jokes.
And the occasional dick joke.
Yeah. Gratiana's supposed to be like, you're a Jew. That's like his best insult.
But like, we're having a conversation, he's like, heh, penises. And then he's like, heh, Jew. And then he popped his collar.
Yeah. Gratiano is the bro of the Merchant of Venice.
He is. That is an apt description.
The rich white boy.
Annoying.
I just hang out with these other rich white boys and...
We're all Christians in name, but never go to church.
And when they say stuff, I'm just like, yeah, right on, bro.
Yeah, those Jews and all their money, even though my dad's a millionaire.
Yeah, right.
And he marries Nerissa just because they have to have
pair.
Another couple.
They have to pair off.
Right, it's a comedy and they have to pair them off.
They have to pair off.
I kind of like the idea that in a couple months Nerissa's just going to be like, oh, fuck.
She's like, oh, what did I it. Do?
This guy's an idiot.
God damn it. Stop with the penis jokes.
It's okay, Gratiano's probably going to be wandering around the city with Antonio and Bassanio anyway.
Like repeating everything they say.
Exactly. Ah, I have a clever observation. Gratiano's like, hey, that thing you just pointed out.
Yeah, right on, man. Hey, remember when we fucked over Shylock? He's like, Jew. This is the only contribution to the conversation.
But essentially that boils down Gratiano's contribution to this play.
And he actually just ends up coming across as a really obnoxious flunky, and
yeah.
I basically hate him by
now. Yeah.
If there was a character I could slap in this play.
That's right. He'd be the first choice.
He would receive my righteous slap of something. I was going to say feminism, but it's not really about feminism.
Yeah, it's not a feminist slap in the traditional sense, at least. More of the Gabs needs to slap you type of
thing. Stand still, I'm going to slap you. We also have another Christian character in Lorenzo, who's also... not very interesting.
He exists like he almost just pops into existence randomly and steals Shylock's daughter and then disappears again.
He does have a couple of pretty good at the beginning of Act 5 when he and Jessica are having their little picnic or whatever, looking at the stars, he has a pretty good speech about the stars, and they start comparing themselves to other pairs of lovers. And then I like it when she says, yeah, and Jessica was with a guy who was just speaking a bunch of bullshit. And he's like, hey!
Hey, wait a minute. That's You're me. Jessica, and I'm a guy! Good job, Lorenzo. You caught on. Because Bassanio wouldn't have understood that joke.
We're boiling Shakespeare down to its purest form.
You'd be like, boy, that lawyer sure looks like my wife.
Lorenzo would at least be able to do that.
What a weird coincidence. Oh, sounds like her, too.
She's the same height.
And the same eyes.
She's got the... And he's got the same great tits as mine. Oh!
Man, I want to feel this lawyer up.
That must be my wife.
It's the old Clark Kent disguise.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Wow, Clark looks a lot like Superman wearing glasses. But Superman wouldn't wear glasses, really, not even cosmetically as a disguise.
Yeah, Lois Lane, I banged Superman, but that can't be Clark Kent.
That's impossible. Hey,
seriously, woman? That is the most ridiculous disguise ever. At least Batman covers up his eyes.
Yeah,
you just see the bottom half of his face.
Yeah.
That strong jaw.
And he uses a dumb voice. Well, I would think Bruce Wayne was Batman, but he doesn't talk like a stupid.
He doesn't speak like someone who just swallowed a bucket of gravel.
So it can't be.
The gravel was delicious. I am not a billionaire vigilante.
I want to hear Batman speak Shakespeare.
If you prick us, do we not bleed?
Jew.
It's out there. You know it is. You know it's
Imagine
out there.
Imagine Batman calling someone a Jew.
No, I can't.
This is the weirdest mental image. Oh my god, that makes the Batman movies pretty crazy. All right. Lorenzo's girlfriend, Jessica. I think she's actually fairly interesting, too, and maybe it's not a coincidence that she's Shylock's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of his interesting kind of rubbed off on her.
Yeah, I'd like to hear a little more from her, actually.
I would, too. And we get little bits and pieces of her character. She's unhappy at home. She's in love with a Christian, mm-hmm. which is not okay with her dad at all.
Well, actually, I think Shakespeare took that sort of subplot of the Jew's daughter running away with the Christian actually from Christopher Marlowe's earlier play, The Jew of Malta, because the same subplot comes through. Only in that one, the Jew kills his daughter.
Oh.
Oh.
Shylock doesn't do that.
Yeah,
man.
That's going to happen in The Merchant of Venice, too.
Shylock's revenge.
Shylock's revenge.
Okay, so the Jew kills his daughter in the Jew
yeah.
of Malta. Barabbas?
Barabbas.
Barabbas.
He was a falcon.
Ben.
Maltese falcon.
Seriously.
Oh, sorry.
Stop talking.
I can't help myself.
The other thing about Jessica, though, you know, she wants to get away. Understandable. Mm-hmm. She even wants to convert to Christianity. Like, okay, I don't have a problem with that. But from what we hear about what she does after she runs away, she kind of seems like a jerk.
It's like, kind of like rebelling against daddy.
Yeah, that's I could see a lot of it that way. Yeah.
But it's kind of callous in the way that she does it.
It kind of is. It's almost like she took his, like, platinum or black credit card. And he wasn't smart enough to cancel it in this scenario. Because in this case, she obviously has cash.
Right.
He's like, I'm just going to spend everything and he's going to be responsible for it.
And, I mean, the one detail that Tony and I noticed because we've studied Shakespeare, and that Ben did not notice because he has not studied Shakespeare.
Shylock is Jewish.
Oh.
God damn it, Ben.
Ben, leave it alone. Is that Jessica decides, I want to hang out with this monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually hands off her mother's wedding ring.
Her mother's,
or just,
at least a ring that Shylock gave to her mother, his wife.
Yeah, and Shylock actually makes a point of saying, That's Leia's ring.
And you gave it away for a monkey.
He's really upset about
it. You know, that's actually really poignant. And what's kind of interesting in the 2004 film adaptation, you know, the one that had Al Pacino in, at the end, the very ending scene we get is Jessica, and we see her still holding the ring.
She didn't actually
give it away.
That was just a rumor.
Right.
I see.
And
No.
I was going to say, that's also part of the kind of mystery surrounding Jessica and Shylock's character, is that famous line or speech of talking about after Shylock realizes she's gone and he's wandering the streets yelling, oh, my daughter,
my ducats, my daughter,
like my money and my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually get that from a Christian character making fun
mm-hmm.
of him.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Right.
Yeah, we don't know if that actually happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like we hear the rumor that Jessica's doing all this crap, but maybe she is more respectful than we think she is.
He took the money so they'd have something to live on, since he obviously wasn't going to dower. It's not dowry, it'd be dower, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I make up verbs almost every time. this wedding between his daughter and a Christian man,
mm-hmm.
especially since Christians have just been giant dicks to him his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And almost a more humanizing moment than the famous speech in some ways, because of the way the audience might have interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that later, actually.
The other thing we don't get from Jessica that can make her a sympathetic character is in Act 5, you know, she and Lorenzo are having a little kind of cute back and forth, and then everyone starts showing back up, and she just kind of stops talking, but as far as we know, she hasn't exited the stage, because there's never
mm-hmm.
anything that says she's gone, and I think someone might even address her at one point. And so she hears all the stuff that happened to her father. His money got taken away. He's been forced to convert to Christianity. And we don't get her opinion on it at all. She doesn't say a single word.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of productions think this is kind of an interesting thing that you can play with. You know, maybe she is in a good mood and she is happy with her decision because she is in love with this guy. And then she hears all this stuff and goes, oh, crap. Like,
yeah.
You know, I didn't like my dad that much and I don't want to be Jewish, but that's really harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe she's just kind of shocked into a sad silence.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty bad string of stuff that was forced upon her father.
Right.
Who, you know, she kind of fled the household so she could marry this man.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not cool. It's happening to your dad still.
Yeah. And I think her dad at least didn't kill her. Like, well, he still cares about her.
Yeah, I mean,
he's mad.
We never see a scene where he's actually treating her harshly.
No,
there's never anything like that.
Because with the one scene where he is talking to her, he just says, stay inside.
Yeah.
The Christians are throwing a crazy-ass parade.
Well, right. Yeah.
Lock up and stay safe.
Having rebels. Yeah,
that's all he says.
That's all he said. You know? So there's really, we never see any motivation for Jessica to actually hate her father. There's no mistreatment.
I mean, you can just, I guess, assume that because she's in love with a Christian and wants to convert, that the household becomes distasteful to her.
Or it could have been that she, you know, if we were putting the play back in its historical context, it might have been just, oh, he's a Jew, he must treat her badly.
Yeah.
You know, it could just been that sort of stock caricature.
Right. But to us it seems kind of, that doesn't really seem to fit together. So.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's throw one more stock character caricature in here before we're going to end up kicking this to a part two, everybody. So you have to wait a week to hear a lot of
because we still have a lot to
this.
Say about Shiloh.
Yeah.
Yes, you notice we haven't really discussed him in depth or the trial,
which is kind of, you know, the biggest scene in the play.
Mildly important.
Yeah, mildly.
Let's touch on one more character and then wrap part one up here. So, Lancelot.
Ah, Lancelot Gobbo.
The clown.
There is a comic relief character for you.
And he's actually, because he originally works for Shylock, transfers over to Bassanio. He says a bunch of stuff like, oh, my master, the druid, treats me badly, but then doesn't give us any examples. So he makes me go out and run errands. I'm like,
you're
oh,
an errand boy.
No.
Yeah.
That sounds, he calls me lazy. Well, you are kind of worthless.
You're hanging out on a corner and messing with your blind father instead of working, so it's kind of easy to see why he would think that. Also, I've worked with people who are very lazy, and they're always the people who are most put out when someone calls them lazy.
Mm-hmm.
This is bullshit. I just said I'm lazy and I don't do good work. You're lazy and you don't do good work. You say that all the time while you're sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah, for the past 15 minutes, while I've been dealing with the 20 customers in the store, you've been sitting there, like, picking your ass. And
that's a lovely image. Thank you.
Food service.
Yeah. You know those people. Lancelot kind of comes across as one of those people.
Well, it's kind of interesting. There's something really interesting about Lancelot's character when we first meet him. I mean, he has this real dilemma. He's working for a Jew, but he wants to run away from his master. And this idea of being a masterless man, someone who wasn't underneath someone who wasn't serving someone, who didn't actually have a place then in society, was something that would really frighten Shakespeare, was a real terror in Shakespeare's day, because, you know, you had all these people who were masterless men who were just roaming the countryside. And Lancelot's thinking, I'm going to do that. I'm going to run away from my master. So it's kind of interesting here that, you know, Shakespeare's kind of exploring this real rich tension here. Should he, if he stays with his master, he's still working for someone who's Jew, so should he be allowed to run away then? But if he does, he's a masterless man, and he has no real place in society then. So he's a threat at that point as well.
Yeah, so he's going to find, he finds a new master
right,
as his solution.
Finds,
yeah,
that's his solution.
We find a Christian master, and then every time someone gives me orders, I'll basically act like a smart-ass teenager.
Yeah.
Is everyone ready for dinner? Well, they all have stomachs. You know what?
That's a pretty good scene.
Yeah, that is a good.
Tell them to prepare for dinner.
That was actually my favorite wordplay scene. That was the only wordplay scene in the play that succeeded for me, actually.
That was a good one. And the scene with Lancelot and his father is really kind of random.
Kind of comes out of nowhere.
He's like, oh, here's my blind dad. I'm going to fuck with him. Like,
Shakespeare is like, oh, right, this play is supposed to be a comedy. Let's put a joke scene in.
Yeah. Right. And then his dad's like, I'm looking for my son. And he's like, oh, are you? Come on.
My dad has cataracts. I'm going to screw with him.
Yeah.
I'm blind, and the only way I know my son is through the sound of his voice, but I can't recognize him talking to me right now.
Yeah, maybe Lancelot's talking in the Batman voice.
Yeah, that's actually, some productions have done that he changes his voice
so that it's not just like his dad's a total.
They make it really high pitched because that's funny.
Yeah,
if I ever stage a production, I will. Now.
There you go. It's got to be one: the Batman voice or the high pitched voice.
Your son, he's not here.
He's dressed as Batman.
Lancelot actually comes out dressed as Batman.
Done. I am producing The Merchant of Venice. Shylock is Captain Jack Sparrow. Lancelot is Batman. Give me your suggestion. This is
that
happening.
No, no.
This is, yes. Put any thoughts in the comments thread on how we should further defile The Merchant of Venice in our production.
My PhD is going to get revoked because I participated in this.
Someone at your school is going to listen and be like, Tony.
Right, give it
not
back.
Happening.
Give it back.
We're going to need that.
You don't deserve this.
All right, well,
good for part one?
Yeah, let's put a bow on it here. So,
save most of that for next time.
We'll save most of our general wrap-up for the end, but let's throw out how you get in touch with us real quick here.
Okay.
So, most of you are probably listening through the website, novelideaspodcast.com. Please feel free to leave some comments on anything you've heard that you liked, hated, or in between.
Yeah, we love hearing anything you have to say about any of our podcasts. You can also email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
And catch us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
Or you can find us on iTunes if you type in Novel Ideas and then click on the podcast category.
And if you do that, leave us a review or a comment.
So we have two comments. and as far as Tony goes, he actually also has an internet presence, so I'll let him talk about his side.
I have a blog called Renaissance Matters, because the Renaissance does matter still. Okay, sorry. I thought it was clever. No, it's renaissancematters.com. It's basically a blog that's devoted to looking at, you know, issues of today and tracing their historical roots back to the 16th and 17th century.
And he does have a couple posts on Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
Even though I think your subtitle is It's Not Just Shakespeare.
It is, yeah.
But that's beside the point. So you can go check him out if you want to hear more from him, and obviously you will be hearing more from him next week when we continue to talk about the play.
Yes, so that'll do it for this time, and we will see you in part two next week when we wrap up The Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, and if you have any good comments on The Merchant of Venice, we could even talk about them since we'll still be talking about the play.
Possible.
Maybe.
Though we might be recording this in about 15 minutes, so we'll see.
Oh, right. Oops.
Oops. Ooh. Sausage is getting made in your presence. Anyway, that's all for this week, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.